Okay, everyone. So we can now continue the Buddha's discovery of the middle way. And we have just seen how he has rejected, first of all, sensuality, seeing that that doesn't lead to awakening. It stops you from seeing things as they actually are. And then also we've just seen how he rejects the self-torment and self-torture as well. And now he's ready to discover that middle path that he's talking about before her. So he, again, he says, could there be another path to awakening here? And then he says, I recalled that when my father, the Sakyan, was occupied, when I was sitting in the cool shade of the rose apple tree, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome qualities, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained attention, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. Could that be the path to awakening? And following on that memory came the realization that is indeed the path to awakening. So that is what he remembered, that is what he saw as the path to awakening. Basically, the jhana states. Yeah, here talking about the first jhana, but if you talk about the first jhana, of course, you are implying all four of them as well, as we shall see in a second. So this is the path to awakening. And it's a very powerful state in the suttas. If we often have these discussions about samatha and vipassana, and what is the path to awakening, and are the jhanas necessary, and all this kind of stuff. But here, it actually calls it quite literally the path to awakening itself. That is the middle path. The middle path is the path of the happiness and pleasure, the stillness, the power of these samadhi states that we call the jhana states. That's a very important statement in this kind of, as part of these discussions that we have, what really matters. It actually kind of brings it to the fore. And of course, the point is that when you talk about the jhana states, you're also talking about the entire path which gets you to the jhana states. So once you are saying the jhanas, you're also implying the entire Noble Eightfold Path, because that is the path that gets you to that particular point. So at this point, essentially, he has discovered the Eightfold Path, culminating in the jhanas. The jhanas being, if you like, the highest expression or the final expression of what that path really is about, because it culminates there. And of course, at this time point, the Buddha wouldn't really have, it's not the Buddha yet, by the way, the Buddha to be here. Here he is just using later vocabulary that he found later on and putting that into an earlier experience. But that, as yet, he wouldn't really have, pronounced these very clear and precise definitions of the jhanas that you have here, which we can maybe have a look at later on, this definition of secluded from sensual pleasures and all of that. So it's kind of a bit of a back reading, putting things back into an earlier period, what he discovered later on. But it's a very important statement, and because it kind of really shows you what this path is about. Now he understands, where he has to look. And then he says, I thought, why was I afraid of that pleasure that has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome qualities? And I thought, I am not afraid of that pleasure since it has nothing to do with sensual pleasures and unwholesome qualities. So now he has taken that final step of dividing the pleasures of the world into different types of pleasures. Those pleasures that are positive, that lead you forward on the path, and those pleasures that are obstructive, that bind you to samsara, that hinder your vision, and stop you from being able to actually move forward and attain any of these superhuman qualities. It's one of those fundamental things on the Buddhist path, this ability to understand where pleasure is to be had. Buddhism is not a path without pleasure. It's just the right kind of pleasure that we are searching for. And this is really the critical thing here. And remember what I was saying before, it is not about Buddhism. The Buddhist path is not about chucking out all the ordinary pleasures we have and then trying to get hold of the pleasures of the spiritual life by throwing everything else out. It's a gradual substitution, whereby gradually you move away from the ordinary pleasures of life, and gradually you increase the pleasures of the spiritual path. That's an important way of understanding it, because otherwise if we try to move faster than we actually can, or faster than what is natural for us, all we do is ending up causing more suffering for us. And that's why I was saying before, if you on this retreat, if you are have any doubt, err on the side of sensual pleasures a little bit, if there is any doubt. Otherwise, you're just going to create unnecessary suffering and problems for yourself. There's a gradual substitution, yeah, one thing for the other. And as you do that, this is also what happens in your meditation itself. You find the comfort where the body disappears, and gradually the spiritual happinesses arise as a consequence. So now he has understood this very powerful importance between right and wrong kind of pleasures. And of course, what is interesting is that those pleasures that come from spirituality, ultimately, they are far greater, far more profound, far more meaningful than any of the ordinary pleasures of life. So I considered it is not easy to attain that pleasure with a body so excessively emaciated. Suppose I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. And I ate some solid food, some boiled rice and porridge. Now, at that time, five monks were waiting upon me, thinking, if our recluse Gotama achieves some higher state, he will inform us. But when I ate the boiled rice and porridge, the five monks were disgusted and left me, thinking, the recluse Gotama now lives in luxury. He has given up his striving and reverted to luxury. They were pretty demanding, these five monks. Yeah, a little bit of boiled rice, and then straight away you're reverting to luxury. I'm glad that these monks didn't see the breakfast that we have these days. Yeah, I mean, that would be really scary. This morning, Venerable Akaliko comes out, oh, would you like some coffee, some toast? Here you are. Very, very nice. But this is kind of the thing, when you are the Buddha, you have to go against the stream. You cannot really, if your friends or whatever are not satisfied with you, well, that's kind of really not the issue. The issue is to find the truth, and you have to be very uncompromising sometimes if you're going to find that truth. So, then he goes on, now, when I had eaten solid food and regained my strength, then quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states or qualities, I entered upon and abided in the first jhana, which is accompanied by applied and sustained thought, with rapture and pleasure born of seclusion. It's a very meaningful formula for the first jhana, but I think it's not perhaps the right time to go through it now, because we are going to have more of a look, hopefully, at these things when we come to the very end of the path. So let's just stick to focus on the right view aspect of things. And we can come back to these things later on. Anyway, and then he does the same thing for the second jhana. With the stilling of applied and sustained thought, I entered upon and abided in the second jhana. With the fading away as well of rapture, I entered upon and abided in the third jhana. With the abandoning of pleasure and pain, I entered upon and abided in the fourth jhana. And at this point, he is ready for his awakening experience. Yeah, and this is what happens next. And the awakening experience is described differently in different contexts. It is one experience, but exactly how you describe it can vary depending on what you focus on, the particular qualities that are important. And very often it is explained as the recollection of the past lives, understanding karma, and then the actual final awakening experience, when you see everything as being empty of self and all that. Yeah, and that is actually probably the most important way that it is described in the suttas. Why? Because, as I said before, these three insights, the te vidya, which I would call three insights, following what Ajahn Brahm calls them, are very closely aligned with the Four Noble Truths. Seeing rebirth is seeing dukkha. Seeing kamma is seeing the origin of dukkha. And becoming finally the awakening experience itself is actually seeing the end of dukkha. Yeah, you understand dukkha when you see the samsaric existence in all its kind of breadth and width and scope. That's when you see what's going on there. And it is scary. Yeah? That's kind of the point. You don't really realize what's going on until bang, your eyes are opened up. You break out of that eggshell and you see, boy, this is what it's all about. And that is what then enables you to let go of the five khandhas and see through this thing which is so hard to see through, to remove the delusion of a sense of self. That is what is so difficult to do without some very powerful motivation to do so. That is why Buddhas are so rare in the world, because it's just so hard. It takes a very special qualities coming together to enable you to see through that. But it's not always explained like that. And this is, here you have the alternative explanation in Majjhima Nikaya 26. And remember that when the Buddha started out, he saw suffering. There was a particular problem. Yeah, and of course, now what this particular way of explaining awakening is to show that now he has found the solution to that particular problem. He has resolved the issue of suffering, old age, death, and all of those things. And this is kind of focusing on that side of things instead. So this is why he says, and now he has become the Buddha. Yeah. So now you can say the Buddha at this point. Being myself, subject to birth, having understood the danger in what is subject to birth, seeking the freedom from birth, I attained freedom from birth, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to old age, having understood the danger in what is subject to old age, seeking freedom from old age, I attained freedom from old age, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to sickness, having understood the danger in what is subject to sickness, seeking freedom from illness, I attained freedom from illness, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to death, having understood the danger in what is subject to death, seeking freedom from death, I attained freedom from death, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to sorrow, having understood the danger in what is subject to sorrow, seeking the freedom from sorrow, I attain the freedom from sorrow, the supreme security from bondage, extinguishment. Being myself subject to defilement, having understood the danger in what is subject to defilement, seeking freedom from defilement, I attain the freedom from defilement, the supreme security from bondage, Nibbana. So all those issues that he set out finding a solution to, he has now found that solution. Yeah, and this then, the very last line here, tells you the insight that all arahants have when they reach that final point of awakening here. The knowledge and vision arose in me. My deliverance, my liberation, if you like, my freedom is unshakable. This is my last birth. Now there is no renewal of being. This is the final knowledge, and this is why the problem has been resolved. Yeah? If you have no more rebirth, all of these things cannot happen anymore in the future. Now everything has been moved away. The deliverance is unshakable. In other words, once you become an arahant, there is no turning back. Yeah, that's it. You have found the final happiness, and you can never again revert back to suffering, revert back to problems. This is the promise of the Buddha. Once you got there, there's no turning back anymore to the old problems before. This is my last birth. This is what the arahant knows directly, immediate knowledge. There is no birth after this. You can see that the cause, the craving, this thing that always projects you into the future, has been removed once and for all. And you know that from now on, birth is finished. This is one of those very important statements in the suttas, because this is fundamentally what you see everywhere, yeah? The problem is birth. The problem is re-existence. The problem is this eternal wandering on. And that is why this is the solution. Yeah, the solution is the ending of birth itself. And for this reason, the idea of rebirth is such a fundamental part of the Buddhist teachings. That is why it is fundamental to right view. We're still talking about right view here. Yeah. So this is so important for actually getting a grasp of what these teachings are about. This is what we're trying to eliminate, ultimately. In the end, this is what it's all about. Yes, there is a lot of happiness, a lot of good things on the way, but this is where it all culminates. So it's actually quite important to have some idea of rebirth and not be too quick to reject these things because it doesn't fit with our kind of ordinary view or whatever. But think about it. Instead of rejecting it, say, okay, well, I don't actually know. Let me just think about this and see where it leads me. And if eventually you have to reject it, so be it. But at least you have tried your very best to see whether it makes sense, whether it is reasonable. It's absolutely basic to the Buddhist teachings. And I'm sometimes quite shocked that people don't understand that. People who have been Buddhist for their whole life still don't really seem to get what, to me, is so fundamental to the Buddhist path, to really understand what is happening and what is going on. In fact, the very awakening experience itself is an insight into the ending of rebirth and birth. Now there is no renewal of being. And that's another way of saying exactly the same thing here. So there you are. This is the Buddha finally arriving at himself, right view, having found the middle path, and then seeing reality for what it actually is. So that is the very initial part of this. I have now mostly been focusing on the idea of the middle way and what that is. And now I want to focus on some of the other aspects of right view. And right view, the way it is defined in the suttas, is often very kind of, stereotypical. So you have to draw out the meaning of this a bit. And one of the most important meanings, as far as I'm concerned, of right view is, yes, rebirth and karma, but there's another way of looking at all of that. That is looking at it from the point of view of the three characteristics of existence. Three characteristics: impermanence, suffering, and non-self. And if you think about it like that, it actually draws out another side of the idea of right view. Because these things, these three characteristics, are things we can actually see right here and right now in our very own very lives. It actually helps us to then change our attitude and move in the right way and then apply the Noble Eightfold Path in the right way. So I'm going to have a look at a couple of, at least one, very profound sutta, but it's also very beautiful. And sometimes I like to draw in new suttas rather than doing exactly the same suttas every time, just to, for a bit of interest, to expand the horizons a little bit, and also after a while, if you hear the same sutta too many times, you kind of tune out. So to enable us to tune in a little bit again, I've chosen some different suttas. But the first of the next suttas here is a sutta I mentioned before. I'm just going to have a very quick look at it because we've already talked about this a bit already. And then I move on to the next one soon afterwards. So this is taken from Majjhima Nikaya, the Middle Length Discourses, number 125. It's called the Danta Bhumi Sutta. Danta is tamed. Bhumi is like the ground, the basis of tamedness or something like that. And this is just one very small portion of that sutta. It's just one of these little similes similes that you find in there. Suppose Agivesana. Agivesana is a monk, the Buddha speaking to this monk. There were a high mountain not far from a village or town. And two friends would leave the village or town and approach the mountain hand in hand. Having reached it, one friend would remain below at the foot of the mountain, while the other would climb to the top. Then the friend who remained below at the foot of the mountain would say to the friend who stood at the top, "Well, friend, what do you see standing on top of the mountain?" And the other would reply, "Standing on top of the mountain, friend, I see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds." Then the first friend would say, "It is impossible, friend. It cannot happen that while standing on top of the mountain, you should see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds." And you know, you think that that guy on the bottom is a bit silly, you know, saying this sort of thing. Yeah, he's a bit kind of, what is he up to, saying that sort of nonsense? Of course, when you stand on top of a mountain, you can see that. When you're standing on the bottom, how can you tell the fellow on top what's going on? And the background to this is that this monk called Agivesana, he had just recently been speaking to a prince, I think it was. Maybe it was Prince Bodhi, again, I can't remember, some prince. Jayasena it was, I think. Yeah. Prince Jayasena. And this prince had asked Agivesana, this monk Agivesana, well, you know, teach me some Dhamma. You know, is it true? And the specific thing he's asking about, is it true that it is possible, according to the Dhamma, to reach one-pointedness, to reach samadhi? And this Agivesana says, yes, it is possible. And it tells him about overcoming sensuality and reaching samadhi. And then Jayasena says, that's all complete nonsense. I don't believe a word of it. Yeah, that's who can believe that kind of fairy tales or something like that? Then Agivesana is kind of feeling a bit kind of exasperated. He's trying to teach some good Dhamma, and people just kind of throw it all away, straight away, without thinking about it. And then the Buddha says, well, this is the kind of simile that would have helped this prince to understand what is going on. Yeah, so this is kind of the response to that. When people think that there is no such thing as higher states of consciousness, this is the kind of simile that kind of draws them back to reality. Yeah, and this is kind of the point of this. The simile goes on. Then the other friend will come down to the foot of the mountain. It's probably more like a hill. The hill. Take his friend by the arm and make him climb to the top of the mountain. This is what the Buddha does. The Buddha makes us all climb to the top of the mountain. After giving him a few moments to catch his breath, he would ask, well, friend, standing on top of the mountain, what do you see here? And his friend would reply, standing on top of the mountain, friend, I see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds. And he might feel a bit silly now, perhaps, for having said what he just said before. Then the other would say, friend, just a little earlier, we heard you say, it is impossible, friend, it cannot happen that while standing on top of the mountain, you should see lovely parks, lovely ponds, etc. But just now we heard you say, standing on top of the mountain, this is exactly what you see. Then the first friend would reply, because I was obstructed by this high mountain, friend, I did not see what was there to be seen. Yeah, he was standing at the base. The mountain was in front of him. He had no idea what was going on, so he couldn't see what was happening. So too Agivesana, Prince Jayasena, there you are, Prince Jayasena, is obstructed, hindered, blocked, enveloped by a still greater mass than this, the mass of ignorance. Thus it is impossible that Prince Jayasena, living in the midst of sensual pleasures, could know, see, or realize that which it must be known through renunciation, seen through renunciation, attained through renunciation, realized by renunciation. So that there you are. That is the simile that I talked about before. The idea that you have to get out of the sensuality of the world. You have to get above it. You have to get the bird's eye view, looking from the top, and only then can you understand what is going on. You have to extract yourself from the problem. Then when you get a sense of perspective, then you can see what is happening. This, of course, is also an aspect of right view, understanding sensuality in the right way, understanding its limitations, and understanding what it means to emerge from these things and seeing it from a different vantage point, a different perspective. It's a very powerful and beautiful simile here. Remember these things, because sometimes it takes a degree of faith and confidence to practice these Buddhist teachings. Yeah, it is not that common for people to attain very deep samadhi. It is relatively rare, but you can start to see, you get this inkling of what is going on through your meditation practice. By just enjoying that different kind of happiness, enjoying the peace, allowing things to calm down, you start to emerge a little bit, yeah? The water is becoming a little bit less wet, the frog is starting to come out a little bit, and you start to get an inkling of what is happening here. And of course, one day you emerge completely here. So confidence and faith does have an important important aspect of this path, because otherwise we're not even going to get started. And sometimes just by seeing other people who have practiced the path before us is also very helpful, because sometimes you get the feeling that someone has achieved something more, something deeper, something more profound, just through the way they live, the way they conduct themselves. You get this feeling there's something there which is very beautiful, profound, very enticing, very meaningful, and it draws you forward, and it gives rise to a sense of confidence and faith as a consequence. So there you are. That's just a little simile. I just find it so beautiful, and I wanted to read it out simply because of that, and also because that Ajahn Brahm often talks about his own experience, but actually this simile that he uses is actually found right there in the suttas, which is always fascinating. So now I want to move on to another sutta. This is called the Lump of Foam, and this is from the Kanda Samyutta. This is the Samyutta on the five khandas, and it talks about the five khandas in various ways. And this is one of the very famous similes that is found in there regarding the five khandas. Remember, the five khandas are the five aspects of personality. We talked about them yesterday. It is really just experience as you have it now, but the five main aspects of that experience, as far as Buddhism is concerned, the things that we need to investigate to understand impermanent suffering and also non-self in a very profound way. So here you go. This is how it goes. And the purpose of looking at this is to understand the three characteristics a little bit more deeply, to help us kind of deepen the idea of right view. But it's quite a profound discourse, so please don't expect this to be kind of obvious or anything like that. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Ayodhya, on the bank of the river Ganges. There, the Blessed One addressed the monks thus: "Suppose that this river Ganges was carrying along a great lump of foam. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to him, and that lump of foam would appear to him to be void, hollow, insubstantial, or without essence. For what essence or what substance could there be in a lump of foam? So too, whatever kind or form there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, if you inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, it would appear to you to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in form?" So here you have the Buddha taking up, first of all, the very first khanda, the form khanda, yes, and comparing it to a lump of foam on the river Ganges. So again, the form khanda, the main aspect of the form khanda is like the physical form of the physical body, including the five senses. This is the most important part of that. It also includes things like seeing, all the sights we see, and all of that. But you can take it roughly to be equivalent to the body for now, because the body is one of those things that we tend to attach to, and the things that we need to overcome to enter samadhi. Yeah? And eventually you have to have insight into this. So here he compares the body to a lump of foam. Yeah, what is it about a lump of foam? Well, a lump of foam is really just a large number of bubbles, you know, coming together. Yeah, that's what lump of foam is. Lots of bubbles coming together and forming like a lump of bubbles, if you like. If you look at a lump of bubbles of foam, it is always transforming itself. Yeah, some bubbles pop, new bubbles kind of arise. It is always changing shape. And as it is changing shape, it is metamorphosing into something slightly different. And eventually, after a while, all the bubbles pop and the form is gone altogether. And this is very similar to the physical body. Yeah, you're always changing. You're always moving to something slightly less desirable, especially after you reach a certain age. It becomes less and less desirable. And you know, it's falling apart and kind of, you know, not being. You look at yourself 20 years ago, I think, jeepers, you know, and then you look at yourself in the mirror, you think, well, gee, well, what a difference. And you're not always very happy with that difference, yeah? You kind of think it's all going downhill. And this is basically the body, always changing, always becoming something else, always going downhill. This is what old age is about. This is what dying eventually is about as well. Moving along. And what is weird is that of all the five khandhas, it is the body that is the most stable. Yeah, at the very least, you can recognize yourself. Yeah, okay, this was me 20 years ago. You can still, there's still a recognition there. But in terms of the mind, it is far more changeable, far more moving from one thing to something completely different within the snap of a finger. So the body, in many ways, is kind of, if you anything in a person is stable, it is the body. And yet, the body is not what we take to be ultimately. We take our mind to be much closer to us than the body. And yet, the body, in many ways, is far more stable. So the body changing all the time, moving into something else, moving towards old age, slowly dissolving, falling apart, and eventually you have to die. It is similar to a lump of foam, nothing there to hold on to, no essence in the physical body. You have to leave it all behind eventually. It's a very useful idea, yeah? You can't hold on to this body. Every time, you know, you become older, you see another wrinkle in your face or whatever it is, you think, oh no, it's either going downhill. Well, this is what's happening, yeah? This is what to be expected. This is the way it has to be. And you stop holding on so much. And then the idea of dying even doesn't seem so bad after a while because you understand the nature of what is going on. But you have to investigate, you have to ponder, you have to be careful. Otherwise, this doesn't actually happen. And this is one of those very important aspects of the Dhamma, that you actually reflect on these things. You bring them to mind. This is the great thing about coming on a retreat like this, having a chance to think about these things a bit more deeply in addition to meditation practice. Yeah, these things come together. It gives the opportunity to bring some more meaning into your life by investigating these things carefully. These things become real only very gradually. Yeah, if you want to reflect on death, for example, you have to do it again and again and again for it to sink in. Why? Because it goes against what we really want to. It goes against the stream of the world, against the stream of craving. So only takes a long time for these things to sink in. It's very obvious on the one hand that we're going to die. We all know that. But even though we know it, we don't really know it. It's not deep inside of us. When we see death, we're still shocked. Why are we shocked? Because we haven't taken it on board fully yet. So you need to kind of bring it to mind again and again and again. And as you do that, things start to sink in. They become more meaningful. And then they become part of the power which drives you forward on the Buddhist path and the path of meditation practice. And so he says here, so too, with form, yeah? And of course, the point here of this kind of the sentence here of past, future, and present, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior, superior, far or near. The point is that there is all form is like this. There is no form anywhere in any rebirth that is kind of exempt from this impermanence. And when things are impermanent, there is dukkha, because you're attached to what is impermanent, you will suffer accordingly. And all form is like that. It is void, hollow, yeah, without substance, insubstantial, without essence. There is nothing in there, nothing that you can claim to be the real you. Everything is just this impermanent, kind of unreliable thing that there's nothing you can do about. For what substance could there be in form? So this is the body. Yeah. So having kind of got the body out of the way, the body is the most easy thing to investigate in terms of the three characteristics. It's the most obvious one because the body is we don't cling so much to the body. The mental things we actually cling to far more than the body. The body we can let go of to some extent. The mental stuff is much more difficult. So see what happens in your meditation practice as you go deeper. Because what you start to see is precisely that, you are able to actually let go of this body. The body starts to disappear. And what a great blessing it is when the body starts to disappear. And you will find, as you do this, as you do your meditation practice, often you come to a plateau. The meditation doesn't want to go any deeper. Yeah, you kind of stay there, and then after a while, you kind of come out of your meditation. And you think, okay, why is that? Why is it that we plateau like that? And there is a number of reasons, but one of the reasons is that we are still holding on to the body. We can't let go of the body to any more profound state. That attachment to the body will go up and down a little bit. So depending on how strong it is at this present moment, that will stop us from actually going deeper. So contemplating the body like this, seeing it as a lump of form, seeing the danger in these things, understanding its impermanence and suffering, actually helps us in meditation, in the long run, to let go of the body a little bit more. Yeah, when I talk about the body, I also imply in that the five senses at the same time. And this becomes especially important when meditation starts to become very deep. When meditation becomes very deep, there comes a point when you have to let go of the body 100%. When you let go of the body 100%, it is as if you are, it's almost as if you will never get the body back again. Yeah, because you are letting go of complete control of the body. You don't know what's going to happen after that. And that is kind of scary. If you have a little bit of attachment to, you know, being able to see, for example, at this point, you have to let go of sight once and for all, as if you're going to become blind. Of course, you're not going to blind. The eyes come back again afterwards. You can see again afterwards. But temporarily, it is as if I'm giving up so much, I'm going blind. So if you are attached to being able to see, yeah, if you are attached to being able to hear and feel and all of these kind of things, it's going to be difficult for you to let go at that point where you enter samadhi in a very deep way. Because you're letting go of control of the body, control of the five senses. And that control means, in a sense, they're no longer yours. And that is the hard part. So to be able to do that, these kind of similes are there to be used for that particular purpose. So if you find that you are going really deeply, some of you have been talking about having some nimittas or upasa, these beautiful lights in the mind, yeah? To go from there all the way into the jhanas, that is where you have to make these kind of contemplations to be able to make that final leap, immersion, if you like, of samadhi all the way into these profound states. Okay. The next simile. Suppose that in the autumn, when it is raining and big raindrops are falling, a water bubble arises and bursts on the surface of the water. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence or substance could there be in a water bubble? So too, whatever kind of feelings there are, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, if you inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, it would appear to you to be void, hollow, without essence, insubstantial. For what substance could there be in feeling here? Here is a far higher, far more radical degree of impermanence. Yeah, a water bubble, of course, arises and plop, it's out of existence straight away very often. It doesn't last very long. Yeah? And this was what I was saying just a second ago about the mental states that come are far more impermanent, far more unreliable than the physical body here. So often, sometimes these mental qualities can arise for a while. You can feel some piti sukha in your meditation. It can last, sometimes it can last for hours even. But still, it is still a very short period of time. In daily life, happiness and suffering are so intermingled. You can almost go from one to the other one, back and forth, very, very quickly. Feelings arising, feeling coming. So one moment you're happy, the next moment you're feeling something unpleasant, and just back and forth like that, so fast. This is feelings, yeah? So unreliable. How much can you hold on to this? If you, even if you attain some nice feelings in meditation, it's not going to be, you can't hold on to that. Then you come out of your meditation, yeah, and then you have to do something which is not so nice, and then you have to leave this retreat afterwards, yeah, and go back to ordinary things again. All these ordinary feelings coming back in your life, you can't control it. There is no essence to these feelings. They come and go according to cause and conditions. Plop, they come into existence, and then they kind of, the bubble burst, and they go out of existence again. And this is the nature of these feelings. There's no control there. Impermanent, unreliable, nothing you can hold on to. And this is the problem sometimes with things like getting into deep meditation, is that you, sometimes people think that this is the real me. This is kind of the Brahmanical idea in ancient India. This is the real me. I found the real core of who I am. And then when I die, this will be what remains. Yeah. But actually, this is kind of part of the important part of the Buddha's discovery, that there is no such thing. You can't hold on to these things. These things are unreliable all the time, even after you pass away and after you die. Feelings are very, very impermanent and very unreliable in this way. Then we come to the next one, which is about perception. Suppose that in the last month of the hot season, at high noon, a shimmering mirage appears. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in the mirage? So too, whatever kind of perception there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, if you inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, it would appear to you to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in perception? It's a beautiful idea of perception being like a mirage, yeah? A mirage is like you see something. Sometimes when you drive on a hot day, it looks like there's a water puddle on the road, yeah? You know that's kind of mirage almost everyone has seen. It looks like there's a water puddle, and as you come closer, you realize just the heat that kind of gives rise to this mistaken perception of what actually is going on. Yeah, and in the desert, hot desert, apparently you can have these mirages, you can see things that aren't actually there. So these are experiences we have all had. And perception is like that. Yeah, what does it mean that perception is like that? The way we experience the world is so unreliable. Yeah, you see things one day, you're sitting here, you're coming out of meditation, and the whole world looks so beautiful afterwards, because your mind is peaceful, you're happy and joyful, everything looks so nice. And then another day, you may be feeling a bit kind of grumpy or sad or a bit depressed or whatever it is, and exactly the same world looks grey and boring and drab. Which one is real? And of course, they are both real. They are real because all of these things are made and created by the mind. It comes from the mind in the first place. And the mind just changes. It's all a mirage. Nothing is really real in the final sense. It is just impermanent, moving around. You can't rely on it. But very often we do rely on these things. We rely on the perception of ourselves, who we think we are. We rely on being happy. Yeah, I'm a kind of happy person. This is my personality. And one day you're not happy. How does that make you feel? You kind of grieve over that. You have lost your sense of self, lost who you are, because you have morphed into a different kind of person. Because who you were, your perception of yourself, actually was a mirage in the first place. It wasn't really real. So the more we attach to how we relate to the world, we have friends, yeah, but one day that friend turns out to be untrustworthy. And that was a mirage. The idea of friendship was a mirage. It was a mind-created thing that actually is changeable, unreliable. You never know whether someone who is a friend later on will turn out to be maybe a non-friend, even an enemy. Maybe they will go against you or whatever. Yeah, everything is so unreliable. And in a very ultimate sense, it actually is incredibly unreliable. You hear the stories of people who are great meditators. Somebody told me a story just a few days ago. And Ajahn Brahm tells the story when he was young, even before he became a monk. You know this story of doing some Zen meditation with open eyes. And he was meditating with open eyes. And then, you know, when you start to get samadhi, but your eyes are open, suddenly your perceptions go really strange. And he said the wall, he was staring at the wall melted away in front of his very eyes. Yeah. What's going on there? Well, it's just that perception is unreliable. It depends on your mind state. If your mind state changes dramatically, what you see also changes dramatically. It's just all a mirage, all unreliable. You don't know when it's going to go away. Yeah, so don't hold on to those perceptions. Don't hold on to the way you see the world. Yeah, you see the world and you kind of, sometimes you think the world is going, not going such great places, but again, this is the mirage of impermanence. The world should be in a certain way. There should be a degree of stability. The environment should be looked after or whatever, but actually the world is just going according to the way it probably has to go. Yeah, and we have this mirage of what it should look like and what it should be like. Once you start to see how out of control things are, you just allow things to be. It is unreliable, impermanent. Don't know where it's going to go next. These are very powerful perceptions, yeah? When you look at, these are very powerful ideas, because we're talking about perception, I don't want to confuse matters. Very powerful ideas of how unreliable, insubstantial it is, and how you just have no choice, but in the end, to let it all go. By the way, the words that I used there, the word for insubstantial is the word for substantial rather, not in, is sara, the same word as in Dhamma Sara Monastery. So it means basically without essence, yeah, without sara, without essence, without anything there that is kind of, that you can touch as real, as ultimate, as final. It's all missing when you look at it carefully here. But again, remember, the whole point here is that you have to inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it to be able to see these things. Then we have the next one. Suppose that a man needing heartwood, seeking heartwood, wandering in search of heartwood, would take a sharp axe and enter a forest. There he would see the trunk of a large plantain tree, straight, fresh, without a fruit bud core. He would cut it down at the root, cut off the crown, and unroll the coil. As he unrolls the coil, he would not find even softwood, let alone heartwood. Now, the point here is that in the Pali language, the term for heartwood is the same word as the term for substance or essence. It is sara, is the same word. So in other words, he doesn't find any essence in that tree. There's nothing substantial in that tree. Yeah? So this gets kind of lost in the English translation. But that's actually what it sounds like in the Pali here. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it. And he would it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in the trunk of a plantain tree? So too, whatever kind of volitional formations. Again, I would like to use alternative translation. Whatever kind of intentional activities, yeah? Whatever kind of will, whatever kind of choice, yeah, intentional activities there are, whether past, future, or present, internal or gross, internal, external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near. If you inspect them, ponder them, and carefully investigate them, they appear to you to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in intentional activities? So here, you have the idea of the plantain tree. It's a tree which doesn't have a core. That's why it says without a fruit but a core, because it wants to make sure you don't get the wrong idea here. So there's nothing inside, yeah? And as you unwrap this tree, eventually there's nothing inside except for just emptiness. It's void inside. And we are the same, yeah? Our will, our choice, identifying with the doer as we do all the time. If you identify with the doer, you're identifying with something which doesn't really exist. There is doing, there is activity, but there's nothing it finally comes back to as being an inherent essence. You are not the doer, there just is doing going on. And this is kind of a hard thing to understand. And this is again some of the things, the unwrapping of this coil, in a sense, is what we do in our meditation practice. Yeah, as you calm down the mind, as you're doing less, as you're having less activity, less things are going on inside of you, you're doing less choosing, less willing, less trying to achieve the meditation, more becoming the passive passenger, the sitting in the seat of meditation, enjoying the landscape. Sometimes not even enjoying the landscape, because sometimes the landscape isn't that great, yeah? But sometimes, often hopefully, enjoying the landscape of meditation. And the more you unwrap that coil, you unwrap it and unwrap it, you get more and more refined aspects of the will emerging as you do that. Until eventually you come to the point when you give up the will completely. And then that is where you enter deep states of samadhi. And this is why the samadhi is such a powerful thing, because it shows you that actually there was no substance to that will in the first place. If it is possible to give up the will completely, if it can go completely, it cannot be you, it cannot be an essence. Because if something is essential, if something is substantial, it has to be there all the time. If something can disappear, it means it is not essential, it is non-self, it is void, it is without essence. And this also tells you why meditation sometimes is so challenging. Because if you identify with the doer, and almost everyone identifies with a doer to some extent. Yeah, I sort out my life, I do things. Some people identify with a doer very powerfully. They can't stop. They always have to do things. I know some monks who are like that. They just work and work and work and work and do and do and do and do. Very hard for them to stop. Yeah, and many, many, many people are like that. Why? Because you feel alive when you do. Because you identify with the doer, that makes you feel alive. If you don't do, it's almost as if you are dying somehow. Something inside of you is dying. But actually, if you are honest and you look at the dying of the doer and you look at your meditation practice, you see, actually, it's a very beautiful thing when that doer dies down. That illusion of the self, the illusion of I am the doer, actually gets in the way of these beautiful states when things become calm and nice and easy. So then when the meditation becomes very deep, the more you identify with that doer, the more difficult it's going to be for you to let go of that. And if you're going to go into a very profound state of samadhi, you have to let go of the doer entirely. It's again, it's as if you die to that doer. It's as if you have to let go 100% completely of something which is so close to you. And that is one reason why it is difficult. This is why sometimes it seems scary. Yeah, because literally you are that aspect in you is actually dying, just like the body is disappearing and the body is kind of you're giving it up for good. It feels like you're giving up the will once and for all, and it's gone. That is why it can seem scarier. But of course it isn't scary. The reason it's scary is because of an illusion. It is the illusion that holds you back and blocks you from being able to access something which actually is far superior. So you eventually you get this by doing it again and again and again, by understanding how the will really is problematic. One day you get it, and then, bang, you enter the state of samadhi as a consequence. The will is gone. After that, you gain a profound insight about the nature of existence. These are some of the reasons why samadhi is so pregnant with insight, and why it is so useful to use samadhi as a basis for insight later on. Because this is part of it. You have given up something absolutely and completely. You realize they are non-self. You realize they are utterly impermanent. And you realize they are suffering because you're far happier, far, far happier without them. Yeah, you realize that about the body. You realize it about the five senses. You realize it about the hindrances. You realize it about the will. You can see how much insight comes out of deep meditation practice. This is one of the reasons why they are so closely related to each other. Sammata and vipassana, always going together, two sides of the same coin, inseparable. That is what this is about. So the will is like a plantain tree. I must admit, I don't really know what a plantain tree is, but you get the idea here what a plantain tree is. No core, yeah? There's nothing there. There's no... I think a banana tree apparently is some kind of plantain tree. You roll it out, there's nothing at the core. Okay, the very last simile. Suppose that a magician or a magician's apprentice would display a magical illusion at the crossroads. A man with good sight would inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, and it would appear to him to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in a magical illusion? So too, whatever kind of consciousness there is, whether past, future, or present, internal or external, gross or subtle, inferior or superior, far or near, if you inspect it, ponder it, and carefully investigate it, it would appear to you to be void, hollow, and without essence. For what essence could there be in consciousness? Yeah, I like the way the Buddha puts it there. For what essence could there be in consciousness? As if it is absolutely obvious. But of course it isn't obvious at all. And this is one of the reasons why he calls consciousness a magic trick. Yeah, it is a magical illusion, the sense that we are the consciousness. It's just a magical trick, and it's a very powerful magical trick, because consciousness is like the very last thing that we identify with. We are the knower. We are the one who is aware. Yeah, very difficult to see that as non-self, as not being part of you. But this is what the Buddha is saying here. If you carefully investigate it, carefully look at it, you realize that consciousness itself actually is insubstantial. It is not something that is continuous. It is something that comes and goes, arises and passes away. It is not, there's nothing essential to it. Yeah, you can enter a state of samadhi where everything stops, and you come out afterwards, and you realize, of course, that consciousness itself was without essence. Or you can see that consciousness comes and goes, various types of consciousness. One consciousness comes, another type of consciousness arises, and there is nothing going through that. There's no continuity between the two that is kind of essential, and it is always there. And this is how, ultimately, you gain insight even in consciousness. It's very difficult to see, but because assume that you do enter a state of deep samadhi. Imagine that you enter a jhana state, for example. And usually when people enter jhana states, unless they have some kind of help from some external teacher like the Buddha, who tells them to investigate even this, if you go into a jhana state, you think that you have, this is it. Yeah, it is. These things are so powerful. It really feels like you have, if you are a Christian, you have discovered God. Surely this must be God. And you see that sometimes in the Middle Ages, some of the Christian mystics in Europe, they would attain samadhi states, because obviously they would have been very good people on top of being contemplatives, and sometimes they attained samadhi states, but because they were Christians, to them that was like merging with God. Yeah, that's how they interpreted it. There's nothing there to tell you that this is God. It's just a very powerful experience. It has some of the characteristics that you might think has to do with God, like unity, like non-duality, like joy, and all of these kind of things, like selflessness. Yeah, it feels incredibly selfless because the will has gone. So it has many of those attributes, but still you are over-interpreting it, because there's nothing really to say that it is God, except that it is a very powerful experience. So this is the problem with these things. When you get to this point, that's why the ancient Brahmins said this is Brahma, this is the end point of the spiritual path, because it does actually feel as if you have discovered the meaning of life. Craving is gone, you don't want to do anything else. If craving is completely gone, it means you have no motivation to do anything anymore. Yeah, you're completely satisfied, completely content. If you really are completely satisfied, there's nothing in you to drive you to do anything anymore. That's why this feels like you have attained the meaning of life. Perfectly blissed out, perfectly happy. Yeah, and then it takes the Buddha to point out, it's just a magician's trick. It is not real. This too is impermanent. This too will have to pass away. Even this absolutely astonishing state of mind will eventually have to go. And that is the problem with this. It is no more substantial than any of the other five khandhas. So this is very profound and very deep. And this is really what the Buddha discovered on his discovery on his night of awakening. So remember this. The point of all of this is just to show you the impermanence of phenomena, how unreliable it is, and how useful, therefore, it is to let go of these things gradually and move toward things that are more and more stable on this path. And the deeper you go in the Dhamma, the more stability you have, and the more kind of a freedom, and the more the less subject you are to the basic, most basic impermanence and problems of life. So, just very briefly, the very last part here. Seeing thus, the instructed noble disciple experiences revulsion. In other words, you are fed up with all these things, towards form, revulsion towards feeling, revulsion towards perception, revulsion towards intentional activities, and revulsion towards consciousness. Experiencing revulsion, that noble disciple becomes dispassionate. Through dispassionate, their mind is liberated. When it is liberated, there comes the knowledge, it is liberated. They understand birth is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, what had to be done has been done, there is no more for this state of being. So there you are. When you see this deeply, you are repelled by all of the five khandhas. Yeah? You don't have anything more to do with them because you understand they are a problem. They are suffering. If you attach to something which is inherently unreliable and unstable, something you cannot control because it's out of hand, something that is without essence, that got nothing to do with you. Once you get that, you understand that you are attaching to suffering. When you attach to suffering, that becomes a very repelling idea. You are repelled by it all, and you're pushing it aside. You don't want to have anything more to do with it. Craving dies down. Because craving dies down and disappears, you are liberated from all of that. No more desire for it. And then birth comes to an end, and you understand that birth has come to an end as a consequence. So, there you are. That is the simile of the lump of foam. It's a very profound sutta. I must admit, I find it very beautiful, very, very meaningful, and very nice. Remember that when we teach these suttas, it's not really to expect anyone here, myself included, I suppose, to really understand this fully. But the idea more is to kind of get some perspective on the Dhamma, perspective on what these things are, so you can reflect on this, and to help you to, as we're trying to do here, to straighten out your view, to be clear about what the Dhamma is. So that will then hopefully enhance your practice and move you in the right direction, and then ultimately be for your long-lasting happiness and benefit. That is ultimately what this is about. Okay, very good everyone. That's all for now. So we'll see you again at 3:00 this afternoon.